Imagine the most terrifying heavyweight boxer in history just, stepping into the ring.
Right, the lights, the noise.
Exactly. And you picture the muscle, the speed, the absolute physical dominance required to just survive, let alone actually conquer a championship fight.
Oh, yeah, it's a completely brutal environment.
It really is. And we naturally assume a fighter like that is a product of pure, relentless physical conditioning. But what if I told you the architect behind not just one, but three undisputed heavyweight world boxing champions believed that all that physical
The
power,
heavy lifting, the road work.
yeah, the sweat,
Yeah.
all of it. What if he believed that only accounted for 25% of a champion's success?
I mean, it completely shatters our modern obsession with the physical grind, doesn't it?
Totally.
Because we are so conditioned to view elite performance through this lens of sports science, measuring VO2 max, fast twitch muscle fibers, caloric intake.
Right, it's all data and physical metrics now.
Exactly. Yet the methodology we are examining today treats the physical body as, well, almost a secondary component, like a mere vehicle for the true weapon, which is the mind.
Welcome to today's deep dive. We are stripping away the myths of the boxing gym to really look at the psychological engineering of a champion.
It's fascinating stuff.
It really is. We are decoding the exact blueprint used by one of the most enigmatic and successful coaches in the history of sports, Cus D'Amato. And to do this, we are drawing from some incredible source material, excerpts from the book Non-Compromised Pendulum by Dr. Oleg Maltsev and Tom Patti.
And Tom Patti's involvement is really what makes this source so compelling.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Well, he didn't just interview people who knew Cus, he was a true
He
disciple.
lived with him, right?
Yes, he lived in Cus D'Amato's house, he ate at his table, trained under his direct supervision. He really absorbed this entire system from the inside out.
Which is huge.
It is, because having that first-person perspective is vital.
Yeah.
Cus's methodology wasn't, it wasn't something you could easily chart on a whiteboard. It was a completely immersive psychological environment.
Right. And our goal today is to dissect chapter one of this book, which outlines the foundational core of Cus's system. And honestly, the beauty of this methodology is its universal translation.
Absolutely.
Because you listening to this might never take a punch to the face in a professional ring, but you do step into high-stakes environments, right?
Okay.
Yeah. You navigate volatile negotiations or high-pressure career pivots or just the daily friction of overcoming obstacles. The psychology of engineering a human being to operate flawlessly under catastrophic pressure, I mean, that's a masterclass for anyone trying to conquer their own arena.
Spot on.
Okay, let's unpack this.
So to really grasp how Cus manufactured champions, we have to start with his foundational math.
The formula.
Right. He operated on a very strict, literal equation to define what he called a fighting machine. He didn't rely on, like, abstract motivation. He relied on this exact formula.
And the formula is fighting machine equals psychology plus philosophy plus skills.
Exactly. And breaking those three variables down, it completely changes the paradigm of performance.
Let's look at that first pillar, psychology, because the text makes it very clear that Cus wasn't talking about sports psychology in the modern sense, right?
No, not at all.
He wasn't acting as a cheerleader trying to boost a fighter's self-esteem. Psychology in his system is defined as the rigorous, unbreakable ability to command your own mentality in absolutely any situation.
And the way he trained that psychology was entirely unconventional. I mean, Tom Patti's accounts reveal that Cus didn't teach this by having fighters punch heavy bags.
How did he teach it then?
Through grueling one-on-one conversations, often just sitting in his kitchen late at night,
Oh, wow, just talking.
talking, but intense talking. He would deconstruct his fighters, he would force them to articulate exactly what they were feeling, physically and emotionally, when they faced a larger opponent.
Digging into the fear.
Exactly. He brought fear out into the light. He demystified it, explaining that fear is really just a survival mechanism, like fire.
Oh, I like that analogy. Yeah.
If you let it burn wild, it destroys you. But if you control it, it cooks your food and keeps you warm.
That is so powerful. Which brings us to the second variable in the equation, philosophy.
Yeah.
And the text describes this in a highly mechanical way, which I found really interesting.
Yeah, it's not what you'd expect.
Not at all. It doesn't define philosophy as a set of morals or, a catchy slogan on a gym wall.
Yeah.
It defines philosophy as an adapter.
Right. And then the third variable, skills, that represents the physical execution, the footwork, the head movement, the ability to throw a technically perfect combination.
The stuff we usually focus on.
Exactly. But here is the most staggering claim in the entire book. According to Cuss's mathematical breakdown, 75% of a champion's success is entirely based on those first two variables.
Psychology and philosophy.
Yes. Only 25% is allocated to physical skills.
75%. I mean, in a sport where two giants are actively trying to render each other unconscious, three quarters of the battle is already won or lost in the software of the mind.
It's wild to think about.
It really is. It makes me think about how we approach challenges in our own lives. It's very much like buying a high-end smartphone.
How so?
Well, you can go out and purchase the absolute best hardware on the market, right? The fastest processor, the most advanced lenses, and that perfectly represents your skills and physical capability.
Okay, I see where you're going.
But if the operating system, your psychology and philosophy, is full of bugs or corrupted or glitchy, that $1,000 piece of hardware is functionally useless. It's just going to freeze the moment you try to open a heavy application.
That's a great visual, but I do want to challenge the limits of that analogy just a bit.
Okay, let's hear it.
Because, unlike a smartphone, human hardware actually degrades under stress.
Oh, right. Good point.
A phone's processor stays exactly the same, whether you were checking the weather or recording a 4K video. But a human being in a high-stakes scenario, whether it's around 10 of a boxing match or, you know, hour 10 of a corporate crisis, experiences physiological degradation.
The adrenaline dumps, cortisol spikes.
Exactly. Muscles fatigue, breathing becomes shallow. The hardware is actively failing in real time. And this is precisely why the software, the philosophy, has to be so robust.
It has to carry the load.
Yes. It has to take over and drive the machine when the physical body is literally screaming to quit.
Okay, that distinction makes the concept of the adapter even more critical, but I want to push back on the mechanics of that for a second.
Sure.
The book claims philosophy acts as the adapter for physical skill. I understand the theory, but how does a core belief literally translate into a physical movement? Like, how does a philosophical stance act as a mechanical adapter for throwing a punch?
It's all about hesitation. It acts as the ultimate filter for hesitation.
Oh, interesting.
Think about the microseconds before an action. If your underlying philosophy allows for even a shred of doubt, like if you internally question your right to be in that room or your right to win, or if you fear the consequences of striking out,
your brain stalls.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Your brain sends a microscopic conflicting signal to your nervous system. You hesitate. And in a championship fight, a fraction of a second of hesitation is the difference between landing a knockout blow and getting knocked out yourself.
Wow. So the adapter aligns the mental intent flawlessly with the physical execution.
Exactly. If your philosophy dictates that you belong there, that you are the superior force, the adapter is completely clear.
No mixed signals.
Right. The brain sees the opening. The philosophy greenlights the action without a committee meeting of doubts, and the physical skill executes instantaneously. Philosophy literally removes the friction between thought and action.
That is incredible. But, if three quarters of a fighter's invincibility relies on this mental and philosophical software, the natural question becomes, who wrote the code?
Right. Where does it come from?
Yeah. Where did Cousteau find a psychological framework robust enough to survive the most violent sport on earth? Because he obviously didn't pull this out of a modern self-help book.
No, not at all. He looked backward far past modern sports. The source material traces Cousteau's philosophical lineage directly back to his heritage in Apulia, Italy.
Apulia. Wait, that's southern Italy, right?
Yes, yeah. Specifically near the city of Bari. And the regions of southern Italy, so Sicily, Calabria, Apulia, they are historically significant for something very specific.
What's that?
They were the historic epicenters of the Spanish and Neapolitan fencing schools.
Oh, wow. But we aren't talking about modern Olympic fencing here, are we? With the flexible blades and the electronic scoring buzzers.
No. This is a historical, deeply entrenched duel culture. Blood and steel.
Right.
In that era and region, the duel was just a fabric of society. And the book includes a quote from a historical figure in Palermo that perfectly encapsulates the terrifying gravity of this mindset.
What did he say?
He stated, "If I can kill you and you can't kill me, then it would mean that I will control you durante vita."
Durante vita. Meaning for life.
Exactly. For life.
Yeah.
It wasn't about scoring points in a game. It was about establishing absolute, undeniable dominance.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because you take this lethal life or death fencing heritage, and you can see the direct, architectural throughline to Custamato's core boxing doctrine.
You really can.
He literally translated the geometry of a sword fight into the geometry of a boxing ring.
That's a great way to put it, that Apulian heritage birthed his defining tactical rule, hit your enemy from an impregnable position.
An impregnable position.
Right. In the Neapolitan fencing tradition, you do not block a strike and then, in a completely separate motion, decide to counterattack.
Because it takes too long.
Exactly. That two-step process takes too much time and leaves you vulnerable to a follow-up. Mm. Instead, the parry and the strike are one fluid motion. You position your body so that the very act of slipping past their blade simultaneously drives your blade into them. Offense equals defense, and defense equals offense.
So how did that actually look when Cuss taught his fighters? Like, how do you become a fortress in a boxing ring?
Well, it manifested in his famous peekaboo style.
Right, the peekaboo.
Fighters held their gloves tightly against their cheeks, elbows tucked in, really protecting the vital organs. But the key was constant rhythmic head movement.
Constantly moving.
Yes. When an opponent threw a punch, a cuss-trained fighter wouldn't just stand there and block it. They would slip their head to the outside of the incoming fist.
Dodging it.
But by simply moving their head out of danger, they naturally loaded their own hips and shoulders with torque. The defensive slip automatically chambered the offensive hook.
Offense equals defense.
Exactly. They were attacking from an angle where the opponent was overextended and completely unable to strike back. They were striking from an impregnable position.
Taking that concept out of the ring and applying it to you, the listener, is just an incredible thought experiment.
It really changes how you view preparation.
It does. We so often approach our goals in a linear, exposed way. We throw ourselves into a project or a pitch or a debate, swinging wildly, completely exposing our flanks to counterarguments, burnout, or competitors.
We lead with our chin, basically.
Exactly. Operating from an impregnable position means rethinking all of that. It means structuring your presentation so thoroughly, doing such deep due diligence, that your defense naturally becomes your offense.
Right.
You anticipate the hardest questions from the board, and the moment they attack your premise, your prepared defense effortlessly transitions into a devastatingly persuasive counterpoint. You aren't just surviving the meeting, you are controlling the room from a position of calculated invulnerability.
It's powerful. But this raises an important question, though.
Okay, what's that?
Understanding the geometry of an impregnable position and embracing the Durante Vita philosophy of absolute dominance, well, that's fantastic when we are sitting here calmly discussing it.
In a studio.
Right. But human beings are emotional creatures. How does a person actively step into this cold, calculating, impregnable state when the lights are blinding, the crowd is screaming, and the pressure is at its absolute maximum?
Yeah, that is the ultimate bottleneck, isn't it? Reading about becoming a fortress is easy. Actually, transforming into one when adrenaline is flooding your system is a completely different reality.
A much harder reality.
And this is where Cuss's system moves from philosophy into what the text calls the doctrine of paired push buttons.
The push buttons.
Right. He didn't just hope his fighters would remember their training. He installed a system of extreme state management.
He did. He understood that you cannot ask a normal, well-adjusted human being to suddenly perform acts of calculated, ruthless dominance while maintaining their normal societal empathy.
They contradict each other.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So he partitioned the psyche. He created a metaphorical control panel with two very distinct buttons. The first is the green button.
The green button.
This represents the citizen. The kind, empathetic, sympathetic person who loves their family, jokes with their friends, and functions healthily in society.
And the counterpart is the red button.
The red button is the fighting machine. When that button is engaged, all human sympathy, all fear, all societal norms are completely severed.
They're cut off completely.
Completely. The text uses really intense language to describe this state, referring to it as becoming a killer or a maniac. It is a state of pure, unadulterated execution of the objective.
And the inspiration for this mechanism is actually one of the most surprising details in the source, I think.
Oh, the tennis player.
Yes. Khajuria was a voracious reader, and he found validation for this concept in the autobiography of a Wimbledon tennis champion.
Tennis, of all things.
Right. This tennis player, operating in what we usually consider a very polite country club sport, wrote that at the absolute zenith of his career, during the championship finals, he realized he had stopped feeling human.
Wow.
He wasn't playing a game anymore. He felt like a machine, entirely stripped of emotion, directed solely at achieving a result. Cuss read that and realized he needed a way to manufacture that exact peak state on command.
And to manufacture it, he relied on physical triggers. He created a psychological anchor.
Because you can't just tell someone to get in the zone.
Exactly. It doesn't work. Cuss created a physical boundary. For his fighters, the trigger was often the physical ropes of the boxing ring.
The actual rope.
Yes. The absolute second a fighter's body passed through those ropes to enter the ring, that was the anchor. They had to mentally press the red button. The citizen was left in the locker room.
That is intense.
But equally and critically, the exact moment the fight ended and they stepped back through those ropes, they were mandated to hit the green button.
See, I have to say, looking at this from a psychological perspective, it feels incredibly dangerous.
It does sound risky.
Right. If you take a young athlete and rigorously train them to partition their mind, to access a state described as a maniac, completely devoid of empathy, and directed only at destruction, I mean, isn't there a massive risk of permanently damaging their psyche? What happens if the button gets stuck?
What's fascinating here is that Cuss didn't ignore that danger at all. He built his entire management style around it.
Really?
Yes. The true mastery of the paired push buttons isn't learning how to turn the red button on. Aggression is relatively easy to manufacture in a high adrenaline environment.
Sure, fight or flight kicks in.
Exactly. The absolute genius of the system, and where Tom Patti says Cuss spent an immense amount of time, was enforcing the discipline to turn it off.
Turning it off is the hard part.
Cuss called normal societal behaviors cabbage leaves, the layers of socialization that keep us human.
So you have to keep the cabbage leaves intact. You just, like, peel them back for the fight?
Precisely. If a fighter leaves the ring, walks out into the street, or goes home to their family, and they are still operating in the red button state, the system has entirely failed.
The machine turns on its creator.
Exactly. They will destroy their relationships, their career, their own life. The discipline required to instantly revert to the green button, to reclaim your empathy the literal moment the bell rings, is actually a much harder psychological feat than throwing a punch.
It's a profound level of self-awareness. It's not about being a relentless machine 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's about having exclusive, conscious, and controlled access to that state only when survival or victory absolutely demands it.
That's the key. Controlled access.
So we have the complete blueprint. We have the 75-25 formula prioritizing the mind. We have the Apulian heritage teaching the geometry of the impregnable position. And we have the doctrine of paired push buttons to manage the psychological state.
The whole system.
Right. And to truly understand how all these elements fuse together in a moment of ultimate crisis, the text provides a vivid story. It shows us what happens when the fighting machine is pushed to the absolute brink of failure.
This is the moment where the laboratory theory is tested in the fire of reality.
Exactly. The story goes that one of Cuss's fighters was engaged in a brutal, exhausting match. He barely makes it through the round and stumbles back to his corner.
He's done.
He is physically devastated. He collapses onto the stool. His lungs are burning. His arms feel like lead. He looks up at Cuss, completely out of gas, and he actually begs him to quit.
Wow.
He says, "Throw the white towel, coach. I can't continue to fight anymore."
And this is the critical intersection of the formula. In this moment, that 25%, the physical skills, the hardware, has been completely depleted.
The battery is dead.
At absolute zero. If this individual is only a physical athlete, the fight is entirely over because the body has nothing left to give. But this is where the 75% has to take the wheel.
A soft one.
Cuss looks down at this broken fighter, and he doesn't offer sympathy. He doesn't press the green button. He enforces the philosophy.
He delivers a response that leaves absolutely no room for hesitation. He tells the fighter, "None of my boys give up on a stool in a corner of the ring. Never. Either get dropped by the knockout or win the fight right now."
If we connect this to the bigger picture, we are witnessing the software completely overriding the hardware.
It's forcing the body to move.
Yes. Yeah. The fighter's physical body is screaming that it is impossible to continue. But Cuss forces the fighter's philosophy to act as the adapter. The philosophy says, "We do not surrender."
And the result is almost supernatural.
It really is.
The fighter, who literally seconds ago couldn't even hold his own head up, rises from the stool. He walks back to the center of the ring, operating purely on the red button state, and he actually manages to win the fight.
It's unbelievable.
But the detail that proves how depleted his hardware actually was is what happens after the final bell.
Right, the aftermath.
When the referee raises his hand to signal the victory, the fighter is so utterly exhausted that his legs just give out. Cuss physically has to grab him by his boxing belt and hold him upright just to prevent him from collapsing onto the canvas during the applause.
The physical body had failed rounds ago. The 25% was gone. The only thing that fought those last few minutes was the 75%.
Just pure will.
The psychology and the philosophy animated a completely exhausted body, refusing to let human weakness override the objective. That is the true definition of the fighting machine.
It's staggering to contemplate the latent capacity we all possess. If we could align our philosophy and psychology perfectly, what could we push our hardware to achieve?
The limits are way further than we think.
They really are.
Yeah.
So what does this all mean for you navigating your own challenges? It means that if you are spending all your time endlessly tweaking your resume or reading one more technical manual or just grinding longer hours at the office, you are obsessing over the 25%.
You're just polishing the hardware.
Exactly. You are polishing the hardware while ignoring the operating system. True mastery requires looking inward. It requires building a philosophy that acts as a flawless adapter, adopting the Duranta Vita mindset to build an impregnable position in your field, and ruthlessly managing your internal state.
Well said.
And I want to leave you with a completely different angle to mull over as you go about your week.
Okay.
We've talked extensively about the strict binary of the green button and the red button, right? Total empathy versus total execution. But look at the modern world we live in. We are constantly pinged by notifications, emails, rolling news cycles, and minor daily frictions.
Constant noise.
Is it possible that the greatest danger to your own performance isn't choosing the wrong button, but living your entire life stuck in a yellow button state?
Oh, yellow button state.
Yeah. A state of perpetual low-grade anxiety where you are never fully relaxed and empathetic enough to truly connect with your family, but never fully focused and ruthless enough to actually demolish your goals.
Wow. Stuck in the middle.
Exactly. A machine with a stuck gear will eventually tear itself apart. Mastery isn't just about accessing the extremes. It's about the absolute clarity of knowing exactly which state you are commanding in this very second.
That is a phenomenal point.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the architecture of a champion. Take these insights, audit your mental operating system, and we will catch you on the next one.